Lecture 6. Characters, round and flat, major and minor.
Not all characters are created equal. In fact, some characters are decidedly more equal than others. There are major characters and minor characters with all sorts of varieties in between. There are narratives that have only one character or only one dominant character. There are also narratives that have ensembles in which no one character takes the lead. George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire has so many characters that the author needs to provide a list of them at the back of each volume. The list at the back of A Clash of Kings, the second volume in the series, goes on for 30 pages. As I've said several times already, different sorts of stories require different sorts of characters. Elizabeth Bennet in Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice is one of the most vividly evoked and beloved characters in literature. She's smart, sharp-tongued, judgmental, and fiercely loyal to her sisters, even when they don't deserve it. But we never get a description of what she looks like, and we don't need to, because what's important about Elizabeth Bennet is her quicksilver wit and her place in the social order. On the other hand, Dashiell Hammett gives us a very specific physical description of Sam Spade on the very first page of The Maltese Falcon. Hammett shows us the detective's gestures and physical movements in great detail, because Spade is a man of action caught in a fluid and fast-moving situation, and it's important for us to see exactly how he moves through his world. Elizabeth Bennet and Sam Spade are two very different characters from two very different worlds in two very different books, so it makes sense that they would be constructed very differently. But you can also have different types of characters in the same story because they fulfill different functions. Take your typical episode of Star Trek as an example. There are the leading players, Kirk and Spock. There are the secondary characters, Scotty and Uhura. And then there are the minor characters, the famous red shirts, each of whom says a line or two if he's lucky, and then gets killed before the opening credits. A red shirt's chief function is to lie face down in the dirt so that Dr. McCoy can kneel over him and say, "He's dead, Jim." Your leading characters are the main focus of the story, so you want to know as much detail about them as possible. But minor characters, such as red shirts, or what they call in the theater the spear carriers, exist only to deliver a line or a plot point. In Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, the main reason you keep reading is to find out if Scarlett O'Hara and Rhett Butler are ever going to get together, and then when they do, if they are going to stay together. You don't read to find out what happens to the Tarleton brothers, the two boys who were wooing Scarlett in the opening pages. In a big, expansive novel like Gone with the Wind, with lots of characters who pop on, do their bit, and disappear again forever, the minor characters only need to be useful and efficient and not much more. You're not going to lavish as much attention on a minor character as you do on your major characters. There are also narratives, such as A Song of Ice and Fire, where no one character dominates, and the world being evoked is the main reason for reading the story. In a narrative like this, you may not have the luxury of long descriptions of each character or subtle evocations of their psychology. Even the major characters in this sort of narrative need to be sketched in quick, vivid strokes because there are so many of them and there is so much story to tell. But it's important to remember that even the minor characters in a novel or a story, even the characters who exist to deliver a single line or just keel over dead, still have something at stake. Part of what I mean is that all characters fulfill a purpose in the narrative, even if it's only to do one thing and then disappear. But I also mean that even characters who only appear once and do one thing have at least the potential to be major characters in a different version of the same story. In a well-imagined, vividly evoked fictional world, you want to create even your minor characters with enough attention to detail and with enough respect for their potential inner life that they could step up and act like major characters if required. Remember what I said in my very first lecture. A plot is only one particular way of looking at a story. The same set of circumstances could be told in countless different ways from the point of view of any one of the characters in it. All characters potentially have an inner life as rich as that of your main characters, and in that sense, all characters are created equal. This potentiality adds to the richness of the fictional world, giving the reader the feeling that the world the writer is evoking is larger and more comprehensive than the story he's chosen to tell. In an imaginary world that has this potential, the reader has the feeling that she could take a left turn away from the main story and just keep going. In fact, over the whole past half century, a whole subgenre of revisionist literature has grown up in which famous stories are told from a different character's point of view. John Gardner's Grendel, for example, tells Beowulf from the monster's point of view. In The Wind Done Gone, Alice Randall retells the story of Gone with the Wind from the point of view of a slave. And Valerie Martin's novel, Mary Riley, retells the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from the point of view of one of Dr. Jekyll's servants. That said, in most narratives, you can't treat all the characters equally. It would read like a transcript of a surveillance tape. Even important characters can be divided into types, not only between different kinds of books, as between Pride and Prejudice and The Maltese Falcon, but sometimes even between characters in the same story. One of these differences is the distinction between round characters and flat characters. This distinction is one of the most famous tropes in the teaching of creative writing, and it was formulated by the English novelist E.M. Forster in his book, Aspects of the Novel. The terms have become so famous that you probably have already heard of round and flat characters, even if you've never read Forster's book or even heard of E.M. Forster. Let's take a moment to review what he actually said. Flat characters, according to Forster, have sometimes been called humorous types or caricatures. Their chief distinguishing feature is that they have, well, one chief distinguishing feature. As Forster puts it, in their purest form, they are constructed round a single idea or quality. When there is more than one factor in them, we get the beginning of the curve towards the round. The really flat character can be expressed in one sentence. And here, Forster gives some examples which may not be readily recognizable to a 21st century reader, so I'll provide some examples of my own. In The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Huck himself is round, but he is surrounded by characters of varying degrees of flatness. A good example of a flat character is Huck's rotten father, Pap Finn, who can be summed up, as Forster suggests, in a single sentence. To wit, Huck's father is a mean drunk. That's all you really need to know about him, that he drinks, that he's basically good for nothing, and that he treats Huck very badly. Like the poor, neglected Tarleton brothers in Gone with the Wind, Pap exists mainly to further the plot. When Huck can't stand Pap's abuse anymore, he fakes his own death and takes off down the Mississippi River with the slave Jim. After that, Pap's only other function in the story is to turn up dead later on, thus freeing Huck from any family obligations. Now, the works of Charles Dickens are famously full of flat characters. You have Uriah Heep and David Copperfield, who is conniving and oily. You have Bill Sykes and Oliver Twist, who is a brutal criminal. You have Miss Havisham in Great Expectations, who was abandoned at the altar on her wedding day as a young woman and has set herself apart from the rest of the world ever since. You might even think of such characters as the sort of people you'd find in a sitcom. The clueless dad, the wacky neighbor, the gay best friend, the wisecracking child. Sitcom characters of this sort are often just machines for delivering or setting up jokes, and the moment they appear on screen, you know exactly what to expect. Indeed, it's that quick identification and the sudden anticipation of something funny, if not necessarily surprising, that often makes such characters so popular. They may be simple, they may be predictable, but they are also reliably satisfying. It's the same with flat characters in fiction. One of the great advantages of flat characters, says Forster, is that they are easily recognized whenever they come in, recognized by the reader's emotional eye, not by the visual eye, which merely notes the recurrence of a proper name. That part, the ease of recognition, is crucial. The most important trait of a flat character is the fact that the minute he or she reappears, you get the whole effect of them right away. Whenever Bill Sykes turns up in Oliver Twist, we immediately know something bad is going to happen. He does the same sort of thing, or threatens to, every time he appears. So although Bill may be a very bad man from the point of view of the other characters in Oliver Twist, he is, from the point of view of the writer and the reader, very reliable and satisfyingly frightening. The fact that he produces the same effect every time does not really diminish the satisfaction of the effect. This, in fact, is what Forster calls the flat character's second advantage, that they are easily remembered by the readers afterwards. Says Forster, "It is a convenience for an author when he can strike with his full force at once, and flat characters are very useful to him, since they never need reintroducing, never run away, have not to be watched for development, and provide their own atmosphere." It's also important to note that a flat character needs to be both simple and vivid. If a character is just simple but not memorable, then the character doesn't really serve its purpose. And if he's vivid but not simple, then he's not a flat character. Now, please bear in mind that a flat character is not the same thing as a minor character. For one thing, a minor character can be round. Take George Wilson, for example, who was the working-class garage owner in F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. He only appears in a few scenes, but late in the story, his grief after a tragic accident is one of the most moving scenes in the novel. Someone who was just a caricature up to that point, the clueless, cuckolded husband, becomes for a page or two a real human being. For another thing, a flat character can be very important to a story. Miss Havisham is one of the most memorable and influential characters in Charles Dickens' Great Expectations. She never develops or changes, and she is essentially the same character in her final scene as she was in her first. But if you took her out of the book, you'd lose one of the major plot lines of the novel. In fact, it's possible to have a story or a novel that is peopled entirely with flat characters. Forster himself claims that all the characters in Dickens are flat, even the leading ones like Pip in Great Expectations or the title character in David Copperfield. And consider Sherlock Holmes. Not only is he the major character in Conan Doyle's stories, he's the main reason we read them at all. And while very occasionally Holmes makes the curve towards the round, as Forster puts it, he is usually triumphantly flat. He produces the same effect in nearly every scene, in every story, every single time he appears. Indeed, most readers would be pretty badly disappointed if Holmes suddenly burst into tears or fell in love or exhibited a passion for anything other than the art of deduction. He is clearly flat by Forster's definition because he never really develops and because you almost always get the full effect of him every time he appears. He's also proof that flat characters are not necessarily simple or sketchy, and that they can be very detailed. Indeed, Sherlock Holmes is one of the most detailed characters in popular fiction, from Conan Doyle's very specific description of his physical appearance, to his distinctive mannerisms, to the elaborately evoked rooms he shares with Dr. Watson on Baker Street. Let's look now at round characters. Forster himself does not offer a formal definition of roundness the way he does for flatness, but he shows us what a round character is by giving us examples. The closest that he comes to defining a round character is when he says that the test of a round character is whether it is capable of surprising in a convincing way. If it never surprises, it is flat. If it does not convince, it is a flat pretending to be round. The very nature of round characters is encapsulated in the metaphor we use to describe them. Round characters curve up and away from the flat page into three dimensions. They have different sides and aspects, unlike flat characters, who appear the same from every angle. Round characters are also richer, deeper, and more mysterious and unpredictable than flat characters. They can do all the things a flat character can do. They can come vividly to life. They can be memorable and instantly recognizable. They can be just as engaging and delightful and entertaining. But they can also surprise us, delight us, and disappoint us the way real people can and flat characters cannot. As Forster puts it, round characters don't just surprise us. They surprise us in a convincing way. This part is important. Flat characters can be surprising too, but flat characters provide only the sort of mechanical surprise you get from a mystery or a spy novel when a trustworthy character suddenly turns out to be the murderer or the double agent. While this kind of surprise can be effective, it can also come across as cheating, as if the writer hasn't been playing by the rules. Our response to this kind of surprise is often a groan or a roll of the eyes. On the other hand, the kind of surprise we get from a round character should evoke not just shock, but at the same moment, the strong feeling of inevitability. You should be thinking, of course, I should have seen that coming. When a round character surprises us, we're delighted or moved in ways that flat characters can't manage, by actions that we didn't expect, but which we believe the moment we see them. Round characters can also break our hearts in ways that flat characters can't. They can disappoint us in a lifelike way, the way loved ones or friends can sometimes disappoint us. The actions of round characters should be both surprising and inevitable. Whatever happens to a round character is probably the only way things could have turned out for them, not because of her circumstances necessarily, but because of her own flawed, complex nature that drove her to it. Take the most famous adulterous wife in 19th century literature, Anna Karenina, from Leo Tolstoy's novel. You don't have to be clairvoyant to guess early on that Anna's story is not going to end well. And yet, her ending breaks your heart, because you have become so intimately acquainted with every aspect of Anna through Tolstoy's ceaselessly detailed evocation of her character. In my first lecture on character, I pointed out that fictional people are different from real people because we can know what they're thinking, which is perhaps another definition of roundness. This is true even if the writer never actually shows us what the character is thinking, as long as there's the potential is there for the writer to show the character's thoughts. By the same token, a character may be considered round as long as he or she has the potential to change, even if they never actually do. Some of the most heartbreaking people in fiction are rounded characters who, for whatever reason, lose their nerve or are defeated by circumstance. One of my favorite short stories is Anton Chekhov's The Kiss. In this story, a dull little man is offered a chance for passion early in the story, does not take it, and then spends the rest of the story thinking uselessly about that lost opportunity. He's the same person at the end of the story as he is at the beginning, but by the end, even though nothing changes, we as readers have a deeper understanding of what he's lost and just how tragic that loss is, even if the character himself doesn't see it. I also want to stress, as I did in the previous lecture, that the complexity or roundness of a character isn't necessarily defined entirely by psychology. It can be defined by their circumstances as well. Both kinds of characters can aspire to roundness. Our old friend Mrs. Dalloway is round because we are inside her head at every moment, listening to her private thoughts. On the other hand, consider Paddy Meehan, a young Scottish journalist who is the main character of a series of gritty detective novels by the Scottish writer Denise Mina. We see these stories from Paddy's point of view, and we are given direct access to her thoughts. But much of the richness of her character comes from her circumstances, from Mina's skillful evocation, through Paddy's eyes, of the dank, melancholy world of working-class Glasgow in the 1970s and 80s. Certainly, Paddy is a psychologically rich character, but her psychology has been formed largely by her reaction to the world in which she lives. She has been shaped specifically by her oppressive Catholic family, her drippy boyfriend, and the overtly macho atmosphere of the newspaper where she works, not to mention by her social class and the times in which she lives, both of which Mina evokes in great detail. So, to oversimplify a bit, we can say that flatness and roundness in fictional characters each depend on holding two potentially contradictory values in balance. Flat characters should be both simple and vivid, and round characters should be both surprising and convincing. A flat character is instantly recognizable, and we view him from a slight remove. The author tends not to invite us to see the world from a flat character's point of view. On the other hand, a round character takes more time to get to know, and often, though not always, we are invited to see the world through her eyes. Please note that I am not saying that all characters need to be likable. Most writers and readers don't have a problem with flat, unlikable characters because we don't have as much invested in flat characters. But somehow, the expectation has grown up among some readers and writers that round characters, or at least main characters, should be likable. This is a pet peeve of mine. As a novelist whose principal characters are universally unlikable, or so I'm told, I take particular exception to the belief that a character needs to be likable in order to be worth reading about. I'm not saying that great characters have to be unlikable. Certainly Huck Finn and Jay Gatsby and Dr. Watson, not to mention countless people in Dickens, are very attractive people. But think of all the great characters throughout the history of literature who are not only unlikable, but downright unpleasant. Achilles in the Iliad is vain and arrogant and vengeful. Captain Ahab in Moby Dick is a heartless obsessive. Mrs. Dalloway is a shocking snob. Lady Macbeth is murderously ambitious. Humbert Humbert in Lolita is a manipulative pedophile, and so on. These are all great characters, but in real life, we'd probably want to have nothing to do with any of them. One of the great things about literature is that we're able to broaden our experience of human nature through reading, with no real risk to our safety or our morals. Reading about Lady Macbeth is a bracing experience, but hearing her story doesn't necessarily make us want to murder our spouse's boss. This brings me to perhaps the most important distinction between flat and round characters, or at least important as it seems to me, since Forster himself doesn't mention it. This has to do with the idea of conflict in fiction, which we will discuss again when we talk about plotting. But for now, I want to make a generalization which may not always apply, but applies often enough that I think it's useful. All characters want something or are driven by something. Or, as I put it a few minutes ago, all characters have something at stake in the narrative. Flat characters only want one simple thing. Sherlock Holmes only wants to solve a mystery, to the point of driving every other consideration out of his head. Miss Havisham only wants revenge against men. Round characters, on the other hand, want something complicated or ineffable or ambiguous. Another way to put it is to say that they are conflicted about what they want, often to the point where they have no clear idea what they're actually looking for. Take Anna Karenina, for example. Not only is it hard for the reader to pin down what's driving her, Anna herself can't articulate precisely what's lacking in her life. She wants her lover, Count Vronsky, but for much of the book, spoiler alert, she has him. And yet, having him does not satisfy her for all sorts of reasons. Her desperation grows as the costs of leaving her husband and losing her child mount up. There's something unreachable in Anna, something even she can't reach, that makes her supremely human, frustrating, and poignant. Miss Havisham, in Great Expectations, is unlucky in love, too, and, another spoiler alert, she also comes to a bad end. But while Miss Havisham's death is lurid and dramatically satisfying, it isn't as heartbreaking as the death of Anna Karenina. Miss Havisham's death is an ironic comeuppance of a flat character, but Anna's death is the last resort of a confused, desperate, passionate, and utterly lifelike human being. So, how do these distinctions between major and minor characters, or between round and flat characters, figure into the process of creating them? With the first distinction, it's pretty simple. Minor characters get less space and attention in a narrative than the major characters do. You don't need a great deal of description or a complicated backstory for a waiter who is simply providing your character with a cup of coffee. But even here, you might want to expend a bit more effort than just saying, "The waiter brought her a cup of coffee." You might want to add an adjective or a clause or two in order to give that waiter a bit more substance than just a coffee delivery mechanism. Even if you say something as simple as, "A sour old waiter brought her a cup of coffee," or "A nervous young waiter brought her a cup of coffee," you're not only adding a little evocative texture to the scene, you're also suggesting that the world you're creating is so complex and rich that if you wanted to, you could follow that waiter home and find out why he's sour or nervous. Now, no matter whether a character is major or minor or flat or round, at some point you need to think self-consciously about his or her function in your narrative. In my last lecture, I talked about two different techniques for creating character. You can either construct a character in advance or let the character develop organically as you write the narrative. Either way, you're going to come at some point to a visceral understanding of how that character figures in the story. Not only is she major or minor, but what does she want, and how simple or complex is that desire? Sometimes this means that a character you thought was round is really flat, or vice versa. A character you thought was round and complex may actually turn out to do nothing more than move the plot along. In the opening chapters of Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles, for example, we meet a character named Dr. Mortimer, who gets a lot of screen time, as it were, explaining the setup of the mystery to Sherlock Holmes. But in the end, Dr. Mortimer turns out to be pretty uninteresting and unimportant. Having served his purpose, there really isn't much more for him to do, and on a second reading of the novel, you may wonder, as I did, why Conan Doyle included him at all. On the other hand, you may discover that a character you meant to be a minor character turns out to be rounder and more important than you thought. Early in my novel Next, My main character, Kevin, a middle-aged man who has come to Austin, Texas for a job interview, meets a middle-aged businesswoman in a coffee shop and is inadvertently rude to her. When I was writing this scene, in which she first appeared, this woman didn't even have a name or a backstory. She was just there for me to show that Kevin was the sort of callow, middle-aged guy who would ignore an attractive woman his own age because he thinks he still has a shot with younger women. Then, without my intending her to show up again or even be referred to, she turned up, much to my own surprise, under very different circumstances at the end of the book. Suddenly she was round and complicated with a name, Melody, and an inner life and a fate all her own, independent of her encounter with Kevin earlier in the book. As a result of this happy accident, I went back and slightly reworked her first scene to make her a little more memorable, so that when she turned up again at the end, her return felt more organic and believable, and not like some plot trick on my part. In other words, in the course of constructing the novel, I had to think self-consciously about what sort of character Melody was, just as I did with every other character, even those whose function or fate didn't change. In the next two lectures, I'll be talking about writing dialogue. The first lecture is about the mechanics of writing dialogue, and the second lecture is about using dialogue to evoke character and tell the story. It's also about integrating the dialogue into the rest of the narrative. In the meantime, here's an exercise to help you think about how different sorts of characters can function in a narrative. Take a story you like, or use a completed draft of one of your own stories. List all the characters, this won't work if you're George R. R. Martin, and leave a little space after each name. Then describe what each character wants as briefly as possible and using only what the story itself says about the character. I think you'll learn pretty quickly who is flat and who is round and who is major and who is minor. Sherlock Holmes's entry might say he wants to solve the crime and impress everyone with his brilliance. Anna Karenina's entry might say she wants the sort of passion from another man that she's never had from her husband, but in truth, she doesn't really know what she wants. These two are pretty obvious, but if you find yourself pausing over that waiter and wondering what else he wants to do besides deliver that cup of coffee, you may discover that you have some work to do. A final word about character. All writers, whether we have thought about it consciously or not, have a theory or at least a strong opinion about what human beings are like. Whether people are fundamentally good, fundamentally self-interested, or fundamentally amoral. We express that theory or opinion through the depiction of the characters in our work. In other words, when we create fictional characters, we reveal what we think about real people, even if the characters are wholly imaginary. The greatest writers have a rich and expansive view of humanity. Shakespeare's menagerie of memorable characters encompasses every sort of person, from the most venal and conniving, such as Iago in Othello, to the comic and endearing, such as the nurse in Romeo and Juliet, to the most conflicted and complex, such as Hamlet. Other writers are not as warm or all-inclusive as Shakespeare. Dashiell Hammett had a much narrower view of human nature in The Maltese Falcon, where every character, from Sam Spade to the femme fatale Bridget O'Shaughnessy, is cynical and self-interested. But while Hammett's view of human nature may not be as nuanced or humane as Shakespeare's, it's still distinctively and recognizably his own. Whether we're creating characters with the power and complexity of Shakespeare's or with the focused, visceral force of Hammett's, every detail, quirk, and foible of a character is like a dab of paint in a pointless portrait of our personal view of human nature. And not just human nature in the abstract. As the great Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges put it, a man sets himself the task of portraying the world. Through the years, he peoples a space with images of provinces, kingdoms, mountains, bays, ships, islands, fishes, rooms, instruments, stars, horses, and people. Shortly before his death, he discovers that the patient labyrinth of lines traces the image of his face.